Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes difficult to imagine, and Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also great. I had a laptop die on me this week and got myself a new one, extra cheap, and it seems to be 10 times as good as the last one. So things like that put a smile on my face, so I'm good.
Absolutely. Well, last time you swapped out laptops was after you ran over your old one. Is that right? Or has there been
exactly. Exactly. I put my laptop down next to the wheel of my car as I was loading something else up, and then, of course, I just got in my car and drove away right over the top of my laptop. And so that's not recommended. That is counter to manufacturing
facts. Yeah.
Yeah, recommendations.
If you read the fine print, they don't actually recommend that you drive over the laptop.
Exactly.
They do frown on that. Well, I want to make a programming note for anyone who's tuned in this evening expecting the first edition of The World Transformed 2. For those who haven't heard the earlier notices, we are postponing that somewhat, and I appreciate everyone being flexible with my schedule. I've had a good deal of stuff going on in my life related to work and in my personal life that has made it impossible for us to kick the series off in the time frame that we originally discussed. The upside of that is we've gotten to hear back from some of the people we reached out to earlier who hadn't initially responded that they were in. And it's given us an opportunity also to think of some other folks that we think are going to be able to participate. So this little pause we're taking before we re-announce when the World Transform 2 is going to start actually is going to enable us to provide an even better and more exciting series than we were going to be able to, which was already going to be, you know, completely over the top. So it's getting better.
Anybody that tuned in tonight thinking that they were going to have, you know, have an you know, outstanding guest in the show tonight and things like that, well, you know what? We got a surprise.
Will not be disappointed.
Yeah, you will not be disappointed. We've got two outstanding guests. So I
can't
wait to introduce them, Phil.
We'll bring them on out. Well, first, I want to introduce Michael Anisimov. He's as our regular listeners know, a science and technology writer and consultant. He's the creative force behind one of the leading futurist blogs, one of my favorite blogs, Accelerating Future. He's a co-founder of the Immortality Institute, and he is the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Great friend to Fast Forward Radio and The Speculist. Michael, always a pleasure to have you on the show. And additionally, we've got with us, for the second time this week, actually, for those who've been listening to the archive program, PJ Manning with us, our official Hollywood correspondent. PJ is a writer and futurist, and just generally one of our all-time favorite people. PJ, always a pleasure to have you on as well.
Likewise, it's a wonderful pleasure for me as well. Hello, boys.
You doing good, PJ?
I'm great.
Okay.
And how are you guys?
Super fantastic.
Super fantastic all the way around. I was saying to Stephen before the show started that I was listening to that archive show the other night, the first time we had you on, PJ, and I cannot believe that's been 3 years ago. I listened to that that discussion. I think, wow, it just seems like we just talked, you know, a couple of weeks ago. But of course, we've had you on many times since then. But it's amazing how fast time is passing, even though Michael has written recently that the future is not accelerating. It certainly seems to be for me when I look back on on the recent past. It seems that time is going by faster and faster. So
maybe because we're of a more advanced age, it seems to be going faster. Maybe for Michael, it really is slower.
Oh, yeah, that's a low blow, Phil.
Hey, I put myself in that group.
Yeah, in this case, Michael, just wait, okay? The future's going to start accelerating. Before you know it. Okay, so we've got a terrific set of topics that we want to get into this evening. This is one of those shows that just sort of came together organically through things that were happening out in the blogosphere, just kind of a nice convergence of discussions that we were having. But just to give a little bit of background, tonight, I think, Stephen, that this might be the most colorful title for a fast-forward radio show we've ever had. What do you think?
Well, we need a colorful title to distract from the fact it's a little bit of a downer topic. But
a little bit of a departure for us, because we're taking a look at the dark side tonight. We're gonna take a look at the importance of looking at the potential bleak scenarios, the views of the future that aren't so happy and rosy. And so our show tonight is entitled "Dude, You're Harshing My Mellow," which I thought was a pretty good summary of that whole thing. And speaking of bleakness and unhappiness, I should mention that Sally will not be with us this evening. I got an email from her earlier tonight, and she had another engagement. So, folks in the chat room, you're going to have to self-organize this evening. Ken, I think it falls to you to organize the chat room with her. Whoever feels like a good organizing principle around the chat room, go for it. So here's how it started. I saw a piece on actually followed a link from Is the Pundit to Michael's blog. I read Michael's blog a lot anyway, but I hadn't caught this piece. And it was entitled, let me make sure I get the title correct here, Michael. It was entitled, "Yes, the Singularity is the Greatest Risk to Humanity." Is that right?
That's right.
I think that was a yes.
Yeah.
Step us briefly through that post. What was that all about?
Well, it was kind of reacting to a post by Aaron Sands on Singularity Hub, where he was actually kind of surprised that the NPR coverage of the Singularity Institute, there's a lot of layers of direction there, he was surprised that kind of put the singularity in a negative light. And I was kind of surprised that he was surprised, because most people call us apocalyptic or doomsayers or what have you, because we tend to think that AI will probably by default not go well. Artificial intelligence could actually be more of a risk to humanity than a potential benefit, and that specific actions need to be taken to make AI so it's less of a risk. And I just responded to the fact that he was surprised. So I laid out some of the reasons why I thought AI could be a big risk, and why the singularity, also known, it's difficult to describe what the singularity is, because there's several different things floating around that mean singularity, but the kind of singularity that we're talking about is intelligence explosion, where a system self-improves fast enough that it can go way beyond humanity in a short period of time. So all I was doing is trying to make as simple of an argument as I could for why that's an issue. And Phil, you actually made it even simpler on your blog when you restated it, so I appreciate that.
Well, hey, if there's anything I can do, it's make things simple, right? That's kind of my
Well, people don't like bad news. So it's easy to create a simple positive message. People won't embrace that. But when you're talking about something negative, if it's complex and negative, that's like two strikes against you and no one will read it.
Yeah, I think, well, one of the things that struck me in your post is you talked about just how reluctant people are to listen to a potential negative scenario. And I was struck by that, because I thought, well, Stephen and I are kind of purveyors of positive scenarios. I mean, we push them out every week, but that doesn't mean that doesn't come from a place where we're going to turn away from a bad possibility just because we don't like it, right? idea that, well, I don't want to think about that because it's not a happy ending. Now, the specifics here, actually, I had two kind of things that converged for me really nicely. Was I had read your post, and I had just been emailed this piece, hey, you ought to link to this top 10 dystopic movies of all time. And I got to thinking about two of those that ostensibly deal with something like the singularity, at least that deal with something like greater than human intelligence, and that was The Matrix and the Terminator. And it occurred to me that as bleak a picture of the future as those movies give, it's actually not nearly bleak enough. That the reality is significantly more frightening if potentially if an artificial intelligence is to develop that that is not friendly towards humanity, they might not be in a position to have a long, you know, like a prolonged war with us, such as is described in Terminator, or to, you know, have some basic use for us, as they did in The Matrix, where they're using the spoiler here, they're using people as batteries. They probably would have, you know, or it's entirely possible they would have no use for us whatsoever, and that if they were not, you know, interested in us, that they would dispose of us as thoughtlessly as the analogy I used was as thoughtlessly as we would put chlorine into a swimming pool, and with utter indifference to the billions of bacteria that we kill in the process of doing that. That might be how an artificial intelligence would eliminate us in pursuit of its own aims, and that is a pretty darn bleak scenario. I think everyone will agree. PJ, how do you feel about that issue? Is that an overly negative view of what the future might hold? Is that something that we should think about, should focus on?
You mean the bacteria in the swimming pool scenario?
I have
absolute belief that the more scenarios we can come up with, the more thought we will put towards potential threats. I really appreciate that many people who are enthusiastic about the future would like to, are hoping for the positive outcome. And as humans, we find it difficult to relate to the negative outcome because, you know, it's an existential threat. We don't like existential threats. But there's a reason why most people who are actually professional futurists do nothing but scenario building, because it's a way to come up with all the ways it could get wrong. And if we know anything from human history, the unintended consequences will always bite us in the ass.
Yep. Exactly. I agree.
So that's, from my point of view, bacteria in the swimming pool, that I won't say it's the least of our problems. You know, it is a very viable result, given what groups like SIAI believe artificial general intelligence could bring.
Yeah, I think there's like a lot of things that stand in the way of people like taking the threat seriously. And by the way, like this threat could also exist with a highly enhanced human-derived superintelligence. Like if there are a way to use brain-computer interfaces to rapidly boost people's intelligence, we might face a similar scenario. I mean, there's people that don't like all people, there's people that don't like other people outside their tribe, so it's not hard to imagine if a human being got extremely intelligent and powerful and could run circles around other people and could manipulate them to do its will, that kind of thing, maybe the same exact scenario could happen. So it's not just limited to AI. I think the AI makes it somewhat more acute because you're talking about a mind on a completely different substrate with different advantages. And I think like when people are really skeptical about the AI scenario, they tend to imagine an AI in today's world with the humans have used so far taking over humanity. And if that were the limitation, then I can see the skepticism. Like I think it would be very difficult for an AI to build humanoid armies of millions of soldiers and aircraft carriers and all that stuff and take on human armies like in that conventional sense. So I don't think that's going to happen. I think it would be something more subtle and more highly leveraged that would be a threat to us.
Well, and that's the issue with science fiction in general. If you're looking at a Terminator scenario, so to speak, you're always looking at it through the point of view of what is our present technology in comparison to the advanced technology that is our threat. And the problem is that's an anachronism. It's going to actually be a completely different scenario than, let's say, Terminator, because the world we're in now does not support the technology we're positing could destroy us. There could be a completely different scenario based on a different world we have 10, 20, 40, 50 years from now.
Yeah, totally. And I think part of the issue is what Robin Hanson calls like near view and far view, like that we kind of organize our mental categories into stuff that's like really immediate in front of us, and then things are more like vague and abstract. And traditionally, like humans throughout history, when they have big, vague, abstract ideas, like far view type things, they tend to make them up to serve some near-term interest. Like, I will preach apocalypse because I want to gain followers so I can have a lot of sex. Like, that is, throughout history, that's been the most common thing. So when people actually come forward, like, with sincere concerns about the long-term future, many people are understandably skeptical because those types of, like, more far-off, vague situations have been used to exploit people throughout history. And without a lot of evidence, people don't have any good reason to believe otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it fits into a category that seems familiar. Although I think it's fair to say it's been about a year since we had Robin on and we talked about near and far. Would the singularity be considered far? I guess it is because of the abstract.
Very much so.
Yeah. So it's far. So that raises the question: is anyone actually getting sex based on their touting of the singularity? I just had to ask, you know. I mean,
we're trying to make it that way so we can become cool and actually do something about the real long term threat. But it's only for the long term threat. It's only to address that, really.
The main thing is to save the world. Yeah, if other benefits accrue, you know, that's just
that would be great.
Right?
That would be great.
Par for the course.
Absolutely. No,
I think. I was going to say, I'm sorry, I also think connected with the what you just mentioned, Michael, of the near and long-term threats, one of the reasons storytelling and drama utilize the near-term world with whatever threat, be it in reality a near-term or a far-term threat, is that dramatically we can't relate to something that's far out for all the reasons you just explained, but you need to perpetuate the drama. You know, I often have people mm-hmm. ask me, well, you know, why don't we have movies about these existential threats? Well, for instance, the bacteria in the swimming pool scenario, there's really not a lot of drama there. it's like, oops, we created it. Oops, we're all dead. There's no heroic arc there.
Yeah, the movie could run about a minute.
Right.
I couldn't enjoy the new Terminator.
The bleakest scenario I've ever heard of, it's even bleaker than Terminator and Matrix and all these other things. It's an old Harlan Ellison story called I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. It's basically, if y'all are familiar with this?
I've read that one, too.
Yeah.
It's basically you have an advanced AI that hates humanity so much. After it wipes out, you know, almost everybody, there's a small group of people that this AI keeps alive just to torture. And that's as bleak as of a scenario as you could possibly imagine. It's a pretty bad one. It's a interesting story,
I think a near miss in friendly AI could be even worse than a complete miss. Because if we tried to create AI that just we didn't care at all about friendliness to humans, then we might get an AI that ends up being indifferent to us and we can't get rid of it and then eventually wipes us out when it gains enough power. But even worse would be an AI cares enough about us to, for instance, like need our input to make decisions and then have some incentive to keep us alive forever. That would be the worst of the worst, case scenarios.
What's scary about those kinds of scenarios is that there's something disturbing about a completely impersonal force, which is how you would view an AI that is just completely other from us, one that has no empathy to us, that just operates from our perspective like just this vast destroying machine. I mean, that's that's disturbing and horrifying in its own right. But something that that is personally involved with us and causing our destruction, causing our pain, is somehow even to me that's more scary, because it's like it's the whole notion. The AI becomes more other at that point, because it's another intelligence. It's like another person who wants to hurt you. I tend to think that those are maybe the less likely scenarios, but actually Michael and I came up with one in this email exchange we had talking about these posts. He mentioned you mentioned that the bacteria example was one example you had thought about, like killing ants. And I related this story. I actually, in my garage, had to destroy an ant colony over the summer. They were digging out my garage, and I didn't know any other way to deal with it. So I killed all these ants. And I was thinking about how that was like and unlike my chlorine in the swimming pool scenario, and how that might be like and unlike an AI that might destroy us. And one of the potential differences is that I had to go to a lot of trouble, and an AI might have to go to a lot of trouble, or might find it very easy to get rid of us and might do it without even thinking about it. The other big difference is, I think, is I felt really bad. You know, I actually had remorse and I had guilt, and I felt really bad about killing all these ants. And it occurred to me that another entirely possible, distinct scenario here would be one where the AIs feel that we got to go, but gosh, it bugs them later, right? And, would we take any comfort knowing that the intelligence that's letting us letting our lease expire, as it were, would be racked with guilt about it at some point further down the road? I personally wouldn't take any comfort from that at all.
Yeah, I think like that a lot of the issue also, like in postulating these like alien intelligences being a threat to us, is that what PJ said, like the drama isn't there as much, and there's this whole like narrative of like political dogma that was built up in the 20th century about on the left and the right, and the notion of like how human beings being lazy, human beings subjugating others, is like the root of all our problems. And like that, I'm not like going to take a stance on whether that's true or not. I kind of think that it's more complicated than that. But even if like today's world were a world like that, where most of the ills are caused by, like, the rich not giving up to the poor, or that kind of thing, it still doesn't preclude the possibility that, like, 20 or 30 years longer in the future, when we develop more sophisticated systems, there'll be a risk. And it's really difficult because there's so many, like, different parts of this argument to why AI is a risk. Like, one is AI going to happen in the next 50 years? Some people think no. And another is, if AI does exist, then we'll be able to replicate itself quickly or improve itself quickly. Yes or no? That's a whole other like component. And the third component is, will AI be able to have physical influence over the world strong enough to actually threaten humans? So there's so much like fill in on each one of those arguments. And like actually, as a result of it being so difficult, the Singularity Institute is kind of working toward the rebranding of itself to focus like more broadly on futurist issues, because we spent a decade arguing this like apocalyptic AI scenario. I think we've reached about as many people as we can reach, and we'll have like that kind of like material still, but we're gonna like actually turn towards a more positive public like branding and viewpoint, because simply that will help us attract more interest and more people and more resources. So that's like our plan change.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
Are you looking at this kind of like a lifeboat institute situation?
No, because that would put the focus on the negative.
Mm.
Lifeboat is like to looking at all the risks. We'd be interested like in all the potential like benefits of technology, and we are very much so.
So it kind of puts Singularity Institute into a class, maybe along with, say, Foresight Institute and Humanity Plus. I mean, there's always been a lot of overlap between these groups anyway, but just in terms of...
Yeah, like probably like addressing issues that aren't addressed that commonly in either of those other organizations, but still it's like... I'm kind of starting to think that maybe we should have even made this move a long time ago, because people just are irritated to always hear about the bleak scenarios, even though being their crucial component of the future. And it's funny because I think of you guys as some of the biggest future optimists, so I get like a little surprised when I see you acknowledging like bleak risks. And I think like part of what makes it possible is if you yourself as a human being have a high innate happiness set point, you can handle thinking about negative scenarios without being brought down by it as easily. Whereas like people with a more typical happiness set point will just get depressed thinking about like world ending scenarios and will just innately like try to get away from that because it makes them sad. So when people think about bad things in the future, I'm saying maybe it means that they're a happier person than usual, not necessarily like a pessimistic person.
That's interesting. That I've never thought about it in those terms, but I like the term happiness set point. I would say Stephen, you and I both probably have a pretty high happiness set point, huh?
I would imagine so. Here we are talking about bleak stuff, and we're having a few laughs too. So yeah, I would say
whenever anybody
so.
Asks me how I'm doing, I say super fantastic for crying out loud. So I feel like I do keep it pretty high. That's an interesting approach, Michael, because it reminds me an awful lot of what we've talked about in our series of posts that I've done, and we've done a number of shows on this. The idea of the human imperative, where we talk about this just ongoing drive of humanity to improve our circumstances, and there has been a shift in where our emphasis needs to be on that historically. And I don't know when it occurred. I don't know if it occurred in the Industrial Revolution. I don't know if it's occurring right now or if it's about to occur in a few years. But there's a shift that is taking place or has taken place, which is one that our main focus is no longer primarily on survival and preventing the bad things. We have to do that. But it actually makes more sense to go for the benefits, to actually go for the positive scenarios, because those are the ones that are best at preventing the bad scenarios from happening. Just from a strictly, practical, pragmatic standpoint of trying to avoid the bad stuff happening, there's a turning point where it's actually better to go for the good stuff than it is to try to ward off the bad stuff. So I don't know. I guess we're in violent agreement here. This makes for a less interesting show. Somebody disagrees. BJ, what do you think?
You're wrong, Phil. You're wrong.
Can you do both at once? Same.
I love this from the chat room. Ken says bunnies and puppies will be much cuter in the future. So.
I really focus on like the bleak scenarios more than like most transhumanists I know. Like one of the other bleak scenarios that I've been concerned about somewhat is the risk of some of the upcoming solar maximum, like knocking out our power grid, because it could be the largest solar maximum of like sunspot activity in 150 years. And also the risk of nuclear explosions in the atmosphere, like causing a large EMP that shuts down the power grid. What's started to happen is that right-wing, Republican think tanks have adopted this as like the cause du jour, and they're using it to lobby for more military funds. So you have like the people that just use it opportunistically to get what they want, and that tarnishes the whole like caution of the message. And then like most people that aren't like far right wing associate that with the far right, and then the like neutral like scientific approach to it gets lost in the interim.
I was going to say, is anybody lobbying for like a more resilient power grid in light of that scenario? That seems to be what we really need to be pushing.
Well, read the book One Second After?
No.
Yeah, I did read it.
It's a good book, but I mean, talk about bleak book. I mean, basically a couple of high altitude nuclear weapons are exploded and causes EMP that basically it wipes out the United States. I mean, within a year, 90% of Americans are dead. And you know, it explains why. I mean, in excruciating detail. He has sort of a afterword where he makes some suggestions as to how, you know, what could be done to keep this from happening. And he says, you know, it could be just as simple as having some, you know, some locomotives in a, you know, in a reinforced bunker somewhere where that cannot be knocked out by EMP that can just deliver supplies. You know, something as simple as that could save thousands. So, it might not be possible to reinforce the power grid like you're talking about, Phil, without spending trillions. But a few simple things could be done, and to prepare us for either an EMP from man-made nuclear weapons or from the sun. So, you know.
They said it would only be a few $1 billion to reinforce the power grid, actually.
Really? So, okay. All right.
Yeah, lower than
and, usual. Okay. So, you know, and in the grand scheme of our budget, that might not be too bad, huh?
I was going to say, don't we spend that a day in Iraq?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And since that's winding down, let's just put a few days of Iraq money into this project.
Into making the grid EMP-proof. But there's that's the exact principle at work right here. Okay, so we Michael introduced this scenario, this EMP scenario, and Steve from the sun. Stephen gave us another variation, which is the same effect coming from. In that case, I guess it was a terrorist attack in the novel.
Yeah, in fact, the responsible parties never stepped forward in the novel.
A great example of how science fiction helps us to rehearse for reality there as well. But it's by entertaining these bleak scenarios, right, that we're able to say, well, here's what you have to do. And the author says, put some locomotives away. And Michael, you've seen an analysis elsewhere that says things could be done for the grid for, it sounds like, less money than the author of that book is thinking that might make it recover more quickly. So, The point being that unless you've entertained that bleak scenario, unless you've harshed your mellow, right, a little bit, you're not going to be ready for this when it happens. We still might not be ready for it when it happens, because the other thing you have to do then is to act, which sometimes things have to get bad before we decide we want to do anything about it. And I think, Stephen, you've actually got a couple examples around that.
Well, yeah. I wanted to add just real quick, Michael, you want to hazard a guess as to who wrote the foreword for the book 1 Second After?
Oh, it was the Luger, senator, or?
It was Newt Gingrich. Anyway.
Gingrich, right. Yeah. He's tied in with that group, author of 1 Second After.
Yeah. The scenario, I tweeted this about a week or two ago, and it was a fascinating article to me that talked about peak oil. And the theme or the point that this particular author was making was that peak oil has already happened, and it happened in 2004. But what we're experiencing is less of a peak than an ongoing plateau. And the reason is that we're pouring more and more resources into extracting oil. And so we're getting the same amount of oil, but it costs us more to get it. Instead of there being a sudden peak and then a drop off, we're on a plateau right now that the author of that particular article explains cannot be sustained forever. And at some point it'll just get so expensive to extract oil to maintain the current level of supply that there's a drop off, and then once you have a drop off plus increased demand from these economies that are coming online, India and China, you get an exponential rise in price of oil. So, that's a pretty bleak scenario, and Phil, we've both expressed doubts about peak oil, at least in the near term, but I think it's a scenario that needs to be entertained. What do you guys think?
I'm going to let someone – I've been talking a lot. PJ, any thoughts on peak oil versus plateau oil versus things have to get better?
If I was Brian Wang, I'd be far more eloquent.
Okay.
Honestly, I don't have enough information to know whether or not we are have, in fact, passed peak oil. I think the argument that Stephen just made, I've also read that recently, I certainly find it a viable argument. Whether or not it's, in fact, true, it's not my subject. I'm sorry, guys.
It's all right. It's all right.
I used to, like, not care about peak oil and think that it was a right-wing nut job conspiracy theory. But in the last, like, 4 or 5 years, or less than that, like 2 or 3 years, I started to see, like, more mainstream organizations being concerned about it. And the most recent is the U.S. military saying that they're concerned about peak oil happening, like, in 2015. And it's all, like, there's different measures of what peak oil is, like, per country peak oil or per world peak oil. And even if we did hit peak oil, the thing is we could utilize tar sands or still have many, many millions of gallons of oil. Also, we have, theoretically, like, 200 years of coal supply. What you can do is do you convert coal into gas, I believe, like, through chemical processes. So it would be more expensive. I think, like, that in our, like, in the next 50 to 60 years, we most, or maybe, like, in the next 30 to 40 years, we won't likely see, like, an exponential permanent uptick in oil prices. I think what we'd see more like of a slow linear increase that will put the crunch on people slow enough that there might be time to develop the golden, the holy grail, I think, of energy would be artificial photosynthesis, and people are working on that. So I'm optimistic that
there's
energy
been
won't
some brilliant be. Advances in that lately, haven't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, there's the issue, you know, of just the economics of it. You know, at what point is it too painful to use oil? That's the point when alternative energy suddenly becomes, you know, when alternative energy prices drop and peak oil rises, where that intersection is where a major shift is going to happen.
You know, Michael, you said that you had suspicions whether that this was conspiracy from the right. You know, I'm going to tell you that people on the right have suspicions that it's conspiracy on the left. And the reason is peak oil. You know, that's they're just saying that to you know, to punish the oil. You know, to get us to you know, go to these alternatives that aren't, you know, they're not ready yet. You know.
Yeah.
So
right. Oil industry left wing thing. So
yeah,
so
peak oil makes nobody happy. The whole idea of peak oil makes no one happy. So. Oh, well.
But that's why everyone thinks it's a conspiracy, because it makes someone happy. And again, we come back to this notion of, you know, be it the singularity, be it gray goo, whatever your unpleasant scenario is, there's going to be a large number of people who decide it's not possible because cognitively they can't handle it.
Go ahead. They forget, like, that argument, like, a conclusion isn't the whole argument, so you can't just react to the conclusion intuitively. Like, you have to pay attention to, like, a few steps that have come before the conclusion, but that doesn't really happen very often.
Well, it seems to me there's two basic classes of the bleak scenarios of the dystopic potential futures. There's those that we can recover from, where, Stephen, to go back to the language that I think you used in your discussion of these two tweets you did, where things have to get better, or have to get worse before they can get better.
Right.
PJ, as you just said, where we feel that pain enough that we then have to make a change. So there's the scenarios that you can recover from, and then there's the ones where you can't. Right? And the sun flare could actually be an example that falls into both categories, because a sufficiently bad solar flare would be something that civilization couldn't recover from. Hopefully we don't see anything like that, but there are astronomical and other phenomena that could occur that could just truly, truly be the end. Just as the AI scenario could be one where, you know, we're just helpless against it, and it's all over, kind of the chlorine and the bacteria in the swimming pool example. So I can certainly understand why people have cognitively have an issue with that second category. But it seems to me that the approach should be exactly the same for both of them, whether it's one that we can recover from, but that's going to cause us a good deal of trouble and pain and suffering along the way, or whether it's one that we couldn't possibly recover from. The smart thing to do now is, having weighed a realistic probability of that particular thing occurring, we should take what steps we can to prevent it. That's the rational approach, but it seems that people are anything but rational when it comes to thinking about these kinds of things.
I would argue that it's very hard for people to, in general, for people to grasp ideas that they have not experienced themselves in the past. That if we're talking about something relatively abstract, let's say peak oil, that's probably the least abstract of everything we've discussed here tonight. They've never experienced that level of pain yet. It's very hard for them to imagine themselves in that. Ironically, that's where storytelling actually kicks in. I would say more people were affected by whether or not you believe global warming is caused by human beings or whatever, it doesn't matter, whatever global change is happening, more people were affected watching The Day After Tomorrow than hearing 300 scientists on CNN explain their data.
Yeah.
That people can't imagine a scenario without building empathy for it. I always had to tie that back in, guys. Sorry about that.
No, that's your deal. We expected it.
Yeah.
It's very hard for people to acknowledge an experience they haven't experienced. The best way to experience something you haven't experienced and will not possibly experience is through a story. So having someone talk about peak oil on NBC is going to have far less effect than seeing the peak oil, the movie.
Yeah. It's like Hollywood is like one of the like kings or queens of the United States in a sense, because it has that like tremendous effect over popular opinion.
I remember the 1983, ABC TV did a made-for-TV movie. PJ, I don't know, you might be too young to remember this, but do you remember a show, anybody remember a show other than me called The Day After?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I grew up in this world, I grew up in this Cold War world where my entire life I knew that we had enough nuclear weapons aimed at the Soviet Union and they had enough aimed at us that we could completely obliterate each other at any time, that this could actually happen. But by the time I was in grade school, they weren't doing the civil defense drill so much anymore. We still had air raid shelters and stuff like that, but they had kind of come to terms with the fact that those really weren't going to do us an awful lot of good, and so we didn't think about that much. So that reality was in my life my entire life. That movie came out. I was like 21, 22 years old when that showed on TV, and I think that was the first time in my life that I ever realized that, you know, like emotionally felt it, and I think actually grasped what it was we were talking about. And it was because they made a movie about it. They showed what would happen, and they showed how it impacted individual people to have the world destroyed that way, basically. And you know, I didn't sleep right for weeks after that. That really changed my whole view of the world for quite some time. Actually,
yeah, I just saw that movie like not that long ago, and like, it's somewhat like frustrating because the fact that so many people that are alive today did live through the Cold War and were concerned about it makes it seem more frustrating, because even when I think about like nuclear war being a major threat today, it seems like people want to dismiss it, even the folks that lived through the Cold War. And I think it might be like nuclear scare fatigue or something like that, because it doesn't seem to do any difference. In fact, like sometimes people that haven't been exposed to any of that seem more susceptible to thinking about global risks.
I think a very good point. I think in many ways we are suffering from a whole number of crisis fatigue. I think it's actually harder to get people concerned about any potential risk, given that they are aware for the first time in the history of humanity of countless risks at a certain level that causes that free-floating continual anxiety. I'd be very curious to see how much that's actually affecting general mental health. We know that back in the Cold War, when people really thought, oh my God, this could be it, this could be the big one, that there were a lot of very depressed and anxious people, especially during the early 60s, when there really was a sense that at any moment someone could pick up the red phone and press the button. Today, we have so many potential risks. We're reading about things all the time. We're hearing about things all the time. I think it's just too much for people.
Yeah, and I don't think that even the people, like the public, necessarily needs to be thoroughly involved in mitigating all of these risks, fortunately. Like, not everything needs to be, like, a popular groundswell of support. In some cases, like, it really is some, like, elite, like, policymaking or intellectual community that can see the risk and do something about it. And in many cases, the cure is relatively inexpensive relative to, like, society as a whole. Like, I was talking about reinforcing the grid, like, a few billion dollars, like, creating a few locomotives that are EMP shielded, maybe a few $100 million, and that could save not just thousands of lives, but potentially millions of lives in a wide variety of catastrophic situations. And I think, like, one thing that's actually good is this, like, environmentalist sustainability thing. Like, I live in San Francisco, so I'm surrounded by hippies all the time, and, like, it can get a little annoying at times. But the idea, like, that people should be more resilient and more local and that kind of stuff, like, you can just be doing that to be trendy or whatever. But on the other side of things, it can make society as a whole more resilient. And this futurist I really enjoy, John Robb, who has been blogging at this place called Global Gorillas, and even been even some, like, warlords in Africa read his blog because he blogs about, like, global security. He has a couple of resilient communities where it ties with the idea of fab labs, like the notion of localizing production. Like, we have a fab lab to build all the things you need, more or less, and virtualize everything else. So for intellectual tasks, you outsource them via the internet. For local needs, you manufacture and do your own local, like, square foot farming and that kind of stuff. And I think that even, like, from an economical standpoint and from, like, a freedom of human being standpoint, like, more smaller units are what humans are more accustomed to. Like, we're not accustomed to living as part of a gigantic, sprawling global civilization. We're accustomed to living, like, in 200-person tribes. I think that if technology enables us to return a little bit more to that, like, pastoral lifestyle, it might not be the worst thing.
Do you guys think that that the fact that the public was so concerned and so aware of the risk of nuclear war may have had some effect in the fact that we didn't experience it? I mean, is there a possibility that, movies like The Day After and On the Beach and things like that may have helped?
Yeah, Reagan was kind of, like, simplistically paranoid about nuclear war, like, in the way that a member of the public would be. And that might have helped.
Okay. All right.
Well, I don't see how it could have hurt. The thing is, it's you look at that. How did we dodge that bullet? There's this story of the Russian who was given the order to pull the switch and didn't do it, and that was just his innate humanity, ultimately, that drove that decision. It was the fact that he didn't want to kill all those people, and he didn't want to be the guy who brought about the end of the world. So maybe to the extent that things like On the Beach and The Day After raised consciousness about that, made people aware of it. I think it might, because that's the one story we've heard. There may have been dozens of scenarios maybe not that far down the path, but there may have been dozens of times when it could have gone that way, and someone stopped it. And we don't know what was driving those decisions, but it seems that it couldn't possibly have hurt that the message was out there and that it was told in such an impactful way that it really got a hold of people.
Yeah, we're actually trying to get that guy Stanislav Petrov to speak at the next Singularity Summit. So if we're lucky, we'll be able to meet him in person.
That'd be awesome.
Awesome.
He's a hero.
A true hero.
He's a hero. Yeah,
yep.
Absolutely.
And I think a bit unsung in his own country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll, you know, what honor could be greater than speaking at the Singularity Institute, though? So it's all getting made up for you. All right. So
like
we got just a... Go ahead, Michael, I'm sorry.
I was going to say our introduction for him would be, like, if you're under the age of 30 in this room, then you're alive because of this man.
Right. Exactly.
And if you're over the age of 30, you're alive because of this man.
Yeah, exactly. You're breathing.
Yeah,
there's
good point.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes left, and, gosh, we hardly even got into the long list of bleak scenarios that I was going to get into. I'd written a post last year called "What If the Jobs Are Never Coming Back?" That was talking about ways the economy could go wrong. We had done a couple shows about that, and that with an eye to talking about making sure that to the extent that we can, making sure that the economy doesn't go completely pear-shaped, and that to the extent that we can, that things work out. Although, Stephen, as I recall, that was another one of those scenarios where what we were talking about was something that might have to get worse before it gets better.
Right. You know, I read another interesting article, and I'll have to find the link on it, Phil. It was talking about how since 1974, basically our manufacturing capability or our productivity in the manufacturing sector within the United States has more than doubled, while the amount of people that are employed in that sector has gone down by over a third. It's 33% lighter. And I guess there is that's the good news, bad news, isn't it? And manufacturing is that we get more and more productive. We are able to make more stuff, but we employ fewer people, at least in that sector. So any rate, that's, you know, I wonder if that's something that can be addressed, you know, and it's something I see getting worse as far as the amount of people that are employed, particularly if we're going to have little 3D printers on our desks at some point, you know.
Which though can provide us a lot of the stuff that we would have otherwise relied on those jobs for. So there's this,
exactly.
There's this interesting potential equilibrium.
So the guy out of work is sitting at the house producing stuff.
Exactly. Go ahead. I'm sorry. PJ, was it?
Oh, I was going to say, from like a human rights perspective, also like depending on China to manufacture all our goods means that we can't do anything for these thousands and thousands of people who are having their organs harvested by the Chinese government because they believe in meditation or something. Like, we can't stand up to these a-holes that are just bullying their own people and doing evil because we're dependent on them to build our products.
I'm sorry, Stephen, you were saying?
I was just going to say that and the fact that we owe them a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. That too.
And infrastructure independent, we would probably be able to take a different stand than we do. Well, that's been one of the interesting things I've seen throughout the last few years. Actually, you don't even hear it as much now, but there used to be this dynamic of whoever was not in power would talk tough about what we were going to do about China, exactly the kinds of things that Michael just mentioned. And then once they're in power, well, hey, we couldn't, you know, we couldn't be better buddies. And it's because of... It's because of those dependencies, exactly, exactly right. Okay, so we got just a couple minutes left. I'm going to give that time to our guests. Michael, any parting thoughts on why bleak scenarios are important?
Me?
Yes.
All right. Oh, do I have 2 minutes?
You got about a minute, actually, because we'll give.
All right. All right. I wasn't sure. Okay, let's see. Why bleak scenarios are important? Because the universe is not our friend, and there's no, or there's not, like, bad, terrible things that happened all throughout history, and it's only very recently, in the last maybe 100 years or so, not even, like, last 50 years, that we've been in, like, this kind of cocoon of material wealth, and it's, like, it's really this bubble of economic growth that we've been in the recent past. And just all it takes is like this one bubble of economic growth and goodness and lack of major world wars, and everyone's like completely Pollyanna-ish and has gone all off the deep end. Like, most people can talk to their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents and talk to them like about their early lives, and it wasn't like, you know, a walk in the park. So like throughout all of history, things have often been tough and there have been major risks. And we just need to, I think if when you study history, you get better, like, understanding of how that risks will emerge, and we'll have to deal with them, and unbridled optimism is not the only way, and it's often more of a social statement about saying, I'm an optimistic, enthusiastic person, rather than, I really believe the future will be good no matter what. So it's important to look at both sides of the coin.
All right. PJ, you get the last word. Any additional thoughts on that?
Well, I think, and this is something I believe, Michael, you've actually written about as well, our sojourn on this spinning ball is quite tenuous. And the fact that we haven't been wiped out yet is somewhat of a miracle. So if we can keep that miracle going, it would be a very good thing for all of us.
Absolutely.
I could not have said it better. That really sums it up. Let's keep it going. And one way to keep it going is to be aware of what might go wrong. So fun discussion this evening. Great having both of you on. And I know we'll be talking to both of you again in the very near future. Stephen, about our music this evening. Before you say what it is, I'm going to lead into the music by doing a quick recap of what's been going on Fast Forward Radio over the last 2 weeks, or over these 2 weeks, the 2 weeks we're in the middle of right now. Because although we're not doing the World Transform 2, you would almost think that we were based on the shows that we've been doing and the guests that we've been having on, both on the live show and the archive show. A week ago Monday was our program with Dave Goble. The following live show, we had no guest, but sort of Stephen Hawking was our guest, and in a sense, God was, when you think about it. And then
God
Saturday,
and Stephen Hawking, that was
God
a great
and Stephen
show.
Hawking, we're both on Fast Forward Radio. Then Saturday, we had John Smart. Then this past Monday, we had PJ Manning. Tonight, we got PJ and Michael Anisimov on the program. Saturday, John Smart again. And then coming up on Monday, we're rebroadcasting our interview with Dr. Robert Zubrin, who is the former NASA scientist who came up with the Mars Direct program, perhaps the most straightforward and simple way of getting to Mars. So having recounted that wonderful lineup of talent that we've had on Fast Forward Radio over the last 2 weeks, what's our music this evening?
Tonight we're going to play Red Planet Blues by Jeff Roney.
All right, Red Planet Blues. Well, thanks for putting that together for us, Stephen. Thanks once again to our guests, Michael Anisimov and PJ Manning. To everyone listening to the program live and those listening to us via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. And until next time, live to see it.